entertainment.ie.
I love the way you say film.
You're very welcome back to The Film Show. I am your host, Owen Ronayne. With me, as always, are Dee Malumbi and Brian Lloyd. How are you guys today?
Good.
What a slick intro.
So slick.
Was that a little straighter than usual? I like just saying the things that I have to say and then beginning to devolve into this stutter that I'm more comfortable in.
No, that's fine. Like, I mean, because you opened with a real strong, like, hello and welcome to The Film Show. I'm Owen Ronayne.
Yeah,
I believe. Completely scripted.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, even though it was still off the top of my head.
Very good.
You
go.
Have you been seeing many movies this week?
I've seen a few.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to tell us about them this week?
I'll tell you about it later on. I don't want to talk about it now, though. I want to talk about the news.
Movie news.
Okay, well, start us off with this Christopher Nolan chat, because yes. I'm giddy.
Right. So, over the weekend, in the US, I don't think it's happened in Ireland, but I know it happened in the US. They screened a 40-second teaser for Christopher Nolan's next film, Tenet. Now, it hasn't been released online yet.
Mm.
There were pirated copies of the teaser put up online.
Oh, I would also add, just with regards to it having not been released yet, do bear in mind that we are recording this on the Tuesday of this week.
Yes. So
quite possibly by the time this podcast goes out,
it might be online.
So
maybe.
Fair, yeah.
Yeah, as of now.
But we're talking about 40 seconds of footage or something.
Yes. Yeah, there's not a huge amount in it. All you see really is John David Washington. You see this kind of like quick tagline about time has come for a new protagonist. Time has come for a new mission. Then you see a SWAT team running down this like kind of night vision thing. Then you see John David Washington in a fight. And then you see the spinning logo of Tenet.
Yes.
And
why is it interesting that it's spinning?
Well,
you've done some research.
Yes, I have. And you can go on to entertainment.ie and read about my wild theories and speculations about Tenet. No, in a nutshell, the word Tenet has a lot of kind of connotations, because there's this thing called a Sator Square, which I could spend the entire podcast talking about. But basically, if you go on to entertainment.ie and just search
It's like
Tenet,
a 3D palindrome.
Exactly that. It's a 2D square palindrome, and it's basically, if you say these three words backwards, they mean the same thing forward, but Tenet is the same in the middle. Tenet is a palindrome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And going by set footage, it appears that there are a lot of like weird camera tricks going on, where it's like stuff goes backwards and then is played forward, and then it looks kind of really weird.
Now, Christopher Nolan has achieved some of these looks in a previous feature.
Yes, he has.
That is ringing bells in my brain cage. And that movie's Inception.
Yes.
Yes. That is one of the fan theories, is that this is a sequel to Inception. Though, I don't know. It's weird, because Brian was writing over the weekend that he doesn't think it's a sequel. And now, as of this morning, he now does think it's a sequel. So I suppose, yeah, we can't really know. I mean, it's definitely got something to do with time travel, or more specifically, I'd almost say time manipulation, because I think it could be to do with going forward and going backwards in time, rather than time travel is usually just associated with going back. So that'd be more like, say, along the lines of Looper or Back to the Future or something like that. I think it's going to be more kind of trippy than that, a la Inception, you know, when you had like the different dream layers, etc. But I still don't know. I feel like there might be some kind of geeky link to Inception at the very end of it, as opposed to it actually being a sequel to the film.
Great question.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you could totally imagine like Leonardo DiCaprio walking out at the end and being like, good job, everybody.
Good job, Cobb Jr.
Yeah, because like, didn't they do that in like The Dark Knight Rises, like when the whole thing was like, you should use your real name, Robin.
Yes, yeah. But I don't think they had any intention of delving into that world either.
No, and that's what I'm saying. Like, I think in Tenet as well, it's enough to just have like Leonardo DiCaprio walk out kind of thing at the end.
Yes,
like, God, it actually was connected.
Which one would make more money? This is the question that will answer our misgivings. If it was an actual sequel, do you think it would? You see, like, at first I was about to say, come on, like, if he's delving into those themes of time manipulation, it has to be a sequel. He's already done it. But then he's got Memento as well, which has so many of the same themes.
Yeah,
there you go.
Without, you know, by well being a completely independent story. Maybe this is just his niche anyway. It's not like Interstellar didn't have loads of time themes as well. Like.
Yeah,
that's true.
I mean, I think
time and space manipulation is kind of his forte.
That's his
really.
Business card.
Exactly, it is. Kind and I mean, like, he great does it fabulously, so no one's complaining.
Yeah, and like the Prestige as well, like, even though that was kind of like more about like the line between magic and science kind of thing.
Yes,
and
sort of stuff.
But there was, again, there was that whole thing of like, you know, moving backwards and forwards in time in terms of the story.
That's right.
I think was really interesting. There's actually a brilliant book. Darren Mooney wrote this brilliant book on the films of Christopher Nolan, which you should check out.
But, I would love to check that out.
Yeah, actually, I gave it to you, didn't I?
No, I think you said you were going to. I don't know if you did in the end.
It's probably in my desk.
Because what do you guys say? Like, not only does he come in under budget and ahead of schedule and stuff, he's also got just the best body of work I've seen of anyone alive, really.
Fantastic. I mean, he is kind of, you know, our current generations, I think, like, big. I know it's such a wanky word, but auteur, he really is, you know.
Yeah.
I'm so excited to see this film. I kind of am just going to go see it on the basis of it being Christopher Nolan. Like, it's sold, you know, everyone is sold on it already.
Yeah, so, that's actually so true. It doesn't get bigger than him.
There's no real need to give out any plot details, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so.
People will rock up one way or the other.
It'll be time crap with like loads of fucking watch out.
Yeah. And I'll be like, shit, yeah, opposite. Here, take 20 quid now. I'll buy it right now. What is it? I don't
you might
care.
You might have to pay slightly more to get into the IMAX. Might be more like 25
quid. 25
quid. But still.
You had another theory as well due to the casting.
The casting. Oh, yeah. This wasn't a theory that I had, but I read a few people saying that the only reason they're putting in John David Washington is so that they can secret cast Denzel Washington.
Sick.
As an older version of the same character.
Sick.
Kind of like what they did with Matt Damon in Interstellar. Which, you know,
I don't think that should be the only reason why
they
cast him.
I mean, he's a really
good
actor.
Wait, who was Matt Damon's character in Interstellar?
Do you remember? He was the...
Old McConaughey? Or
no, I can't remember he was the scientist that was like left stranded on a planet.
You're thinking of the Martian man.
No, that is no, his character is
No, I won't hear it. It's the Spud film you're after.
The one where he fertilized the ground with his own shit. It's that film, isn't it? Yeah. No, when Matt Damon was
Yeah, not since the cinema.
Yeah, there was the whole thing where like they landed on the planet where there was this scientist, his name was Wolf, I think.
By the way, this is a bit of a spoiler, but you really should have seen Interstellar.
Yeah.
Like,
what about the Martian?
Yeah, no.
Like, the whole point is that.
Sorry. Anyway, okay. Well, look, it's important to list the rest of the cast here because it actually is incredibly impressive. We've got John David Washington. This is The Martian I'm talking about now. No, it's not. No, it's Tenet. But Robert Pattinson continues. We had a good old Rob Pat chat last week about The Lighthouse.
Rob Pat chat.
Yeah.
Love it.
Nice. I was trying to remember if he had a real nickname, so I just have both chat. His names.
Yeah.
There you go. Elizabeth Debicki, Aaron Taylor Johnson, Michael Caine. And Kenneth Branagh.
I am Kenneth Branagh. Yeah.
I would watch it, but like, yeah, because even he was brilliant in Dunkirk, I thought,
brilliant
with his small role.
Yeah.
So
strangely underplayed it in Dunkirk, I felt.
Yeah, but in a good way.
Yeah, no, like I know, in a really good way. That's
yeah, he was just on a pier, wasn't he?
Yeah, but like, holy shit, the way he's still on that pier, acting,
yeah,
amazing.
And looking at like, you know, the oncoming war and everything.
Do you think Michael Caine is going to tear up in this one?
I mean, like, maybe. Yeah. You've got to imagine he's got like the quiver. He's got, you know, get that quiver in the voice.
I love that Nolan has a recurring cast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always a good sign. That is always a good sign. Like, I was watching Wind River last night, and that's Taylor Sheridan. But, like, there was a lot of people who were in Wind River are also in that TV series he does, Yellowstone.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, and I was watching it. I was like, yeah, that's really cool that he uses the same people over and over again.
He knows what he can get out of
them. Exactly. He knows what he can get out of them, and they feel comfortable and they can interpret. It's the best. Like, it never bothers me when directors use the same actors again.
Absolutely, yeah.
They know they can write exactly for them. Mm-hmm. They know exactly what they're capable of doing, and they can get the best possible performance out of them.
And it's a two-way thing as well, because the actors respect those directors enough that they want to go back and work with them again and again, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Great spot. Great. Okay, news piece number two. Oh,
I have words to say about this one.
Oh, wow.
I'll announce it first. So Venom 2 has just been announced and there is a director attached, Mr. Andy Serkis.
Yeah, when this was announced, Owen was really excited. He was like, oh, it's great, Andy Serkis. And I was like, have you seen his movies?
I have not seen Mowgli.
No, Mowgli is quite dreadful. And I mean, this was like his kind of big opportunity, you know, his big budget movie, CGI, amazing cast and everything. And he completely blew it. He completely fucked it up. He really did. He went over budget. The film didn't even get a theatrical release. It ended up going straight to Netflix because it was so terrible.
And how did
it
this
looks
line up?
Cheap.
Sorry if this is a bigger question, but you know how this happens every now and then where a mirror image release of something like Jon Favreau's Jungle Book or whatever.
They were like in the works at around the same time, and Warner Brothers were pushing really, really hard to get out Mowgli first, and then they just couldn't on time. So they were like, okay, fine, we'll leave it. We'll let a bit of time pass. And I mean, this will give Andy a bit more time to improve it and everything. Apparently, it was unimprovable.
Yeah, literally. Were they going off the source material, or how did they get around Disney knowing what the Jungle Book is? Do you know what I mean?
My understanding of it, well, like, I mean, obviously, like, the Jungle Book is based on the Rudyard Kipling book. Like, and the story was that Andy Serkis's version was going to completely adhere to the source material.
Okay.
And the source material is quite dark. Like, of course, it's very, like, you know, like, Mowgli's parents were, like, killed by wolves. You know, it's very, very dark. And whereas the Jungle Book, the one that Jon Favreau did, that was just completely based on the cartoon that everyone remembers. Like. Mm-hmm. So it's, but I mean, there's been like plenty of examples of like both movies doing very, very well, like Deep Impact and Armageddon.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Volcano.
That's your best.
No, but like there's
Volcano Sprinters, Dante's Peak.
Yeah, Dante's Peak and Volcano. And then there's like, yeah, like I said, Deep Impact and Armageddon. And, you know, like,
Christopher Nolan, what was it? The Illusionist and the...
And The Prestige. Yeah, exactly. So like,
Ants and A Bug's Life were out around the same time, I think.
I love these. Yeah. I could listen to these all. Is there other recent ones? Sorry, I'm going to keep putting you on.
I'm going to go animation again because that's just my forte. Finding Nemo and Shark Tale were out around the same time as well.
Yes. So there you go.
Yeah.
Shark Tale didn't age well. I saw it again a couple of months ago.
It did not.
I still quite like it, but I do think it's mostly the soundtrack that I absolutely adore. I could just like dance that soundtrack
like Christina
all day.
Aguilera doing Car Wash. Like, what a sound.
Yeah, that is the main thing, yeah. And that fish looks like Will Smith.
Yes.
Yeah, and the ears.
And,
yeah.
And as well, to be fair, like the Robert De Niro shark. Good cast.
Was very good, the whole Goodfellas and the shark bit. I love that. That was gas.
It's not as good as Goodfellas.
Who would have thought De Niro, before The Irishman, we'll see how it goes, was literally, like, he went from that role to that bagel thing. He literally cast the mobster thing further and further, as low as he can go.
Yeah, and now he's going to try to bring it back up again.
I'm annoyed at him now.
I have talked about this before. About Robert
Is the well infinite of how much space we'll give him because he's Raging Bull?
I don't know. Like, I like personally myself, like, I lost all respect for him after Dirty Grandpa.
Yeah.
I have, and I think you were there when I came. I remember coming out of screening from that, and I was physically angry. I've never actually sat down and wrote a more angry review than I did for Dirty. I hated it. I hated it.
I remember it was immediate, like, worst of the year for you. Like, it wasn't even contention. Yeah.
And is that just because you can see the money changing hands?
Correct.
As his face goes.
Correct. I was like, geez. I was like, what cost is your soul, Robert De Niro? How much is your soul
and
worth?
I even remember, like, years ago when Meet the Parents was coming out, everyone's like, what is this weird comedy Robert De Niro's doing? Yeah. And then that ended up, like, being such a hit and people loved it.
Yeah.
And then he kind of kept going along the comedy route. But just getting crummier.
What's the
and
Hugh
crummier.
Grant one? Where he's fantastic.
Mickey Blue Eyes.
Mickey Blue Eyes. I love that film.
Yeah. And but like, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Like, I get that. Like, when you get to Robert De Niro's stage, like, I mean, this is the guy who, you know, lost all the weight put on all the weight and did all the tattoos for Cape Fear. Learned how to box for Raging Bull. He's the guy. He is the method man. Like, he's the guy who, like, I get that. Like, when you get into a certain age and stage of your career, that you're like,
you love money.
Well, you don't want to work so hard anymore. Like, I totally get that. But like, Jesus Christ! Like, have a bit of respect for the love of God. Like, him and Al Pacino.
Have you,
like,
even tried those bagels?
I don't care. They could be the best bagel. I love bagels. They could be the best bagels ever. I don't give a shit. I'm not going to eat them. And Robert De Niro's not going to convince me. Like, forget it.
I'm just after realizing we've gone so far off.
Andy Serkis directing Venom. Anyway, just to
complete my point. So I've seen both of the films that he directed. I also saw Breathe.
Yeah.
Which terrible. Is really, I quite liked Muck. It. I thought it was nice. Like, it was a very easy movie to direct. It was basically this romantic drama based on a true story of this man who basically went paralyzed when he contracted polio from the neck down, and he had just gotten married and his wife was expecting and everything, and basically his wife and him kind of invented the wheelchair, which was completely transformed, you know, the handicapped community, because suddenly their standard of life vastly improved. So it's like an amazing story, and it was really inspiring, and I thought it was very sweet and romantic, and I thought Claire Foy and Andrew Garfield were great in it. So I was like, okay, well, fair enough, you know, I'll watch out to see what Andy Serkis does next. You know, he obviously can direct. And then I saw Mowgli and I was like, oh no, I guess not. But I think it's a really weird choice to give him Venom 2 off the back of Mowgli.
It's a tough IP because, anyway.
Did he say that?
Because he's shown that he made a complete balls out of like directing CGI and big budget and all of that,
well,
you know?
I don't know if I necessarily agree, and I'll give you my reasons why I think he was actually a really good director. I think obviously he knows mocap and CGI because he's Andy Serkis. He's the guy who was in, you know,
he
is the king of mocap and stuff like that. So he's able to direct it very, very well.
But then what happened with Mowgli?
Well, this is
story.
It.
Story.
I think in the case of Mowgli, I think the amount of producers that changed hands, there was nobody actually standing over and guiding them, or at least kind of reining them in for going over budget or doing whatever. Whereas with something like Venom, because it's such a heavily, heavily, heavily produced franchise, like it's like Marvel, like when, you know, when you bring in a director for a Marvel movie, chances are the director's going to get to do maybe 70% of the film.
Yeah,
and then
the
rest of it will be taken
kind
off.
Kind of studio driven.
Exactly, yeah,
they're shooed away.
It's like, right, you've done your thing now. Now we're going to...
But this is Venom.
But
also, how much influence is mocap specifically type CGI actually going to have a factor here? Because like Venom isn't mocap.
Is it? Yeah, it is. Like literally,
when Tom Hardy does it, it is?
Yeah, he wears like the thing, like the grey suit and the camera
but
thing.
Like it's just like giant eyes and mouth.
It's all done on set nowadays.
It's all done
anyway,
on set.
But like,
is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it is.
I agree as well that you know, obviously there's more to films than the mocap that goes into it at the end.
Completely.
Like, but
completely. I mean, I think, you know, you're right. Like Mowgli was such a complete and utter, pardon my language, clusterfuck, that there would be for any other director, I think there'd be no way out.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, I'd say this is like the last spin of the wheel. Like, if he doesn't turn Venom 2 into something
that can
work, then forget it. Like,
I know, I wish I was more excited. I wasn't excited for it anyway.
No.
Yeah.
I was amazed that it did so well.
Look, we'll see. And I suppose I do accept your point, Brian, about the whole having the studio backing and kind of studio almost control will probably help. But I don't know. I can't help but be just... Mowgli was such a mess. I just can't feel that enthusiastic about it. And also, as you guys mentioned there, the fact that Venom wasn't a particularly good movie either. I just find it hard to get excited about.
That's why I was happy for him, though. I was like, oh, Andy Serkis, he's
good for him.
I wasn't familiar with his directing. Oh, I just knew him as terrible. Like a bit of a like campaigning a lot for the Labour Party in the UK and being a generally nice kind of northern
man. Sure.
I'm sure he's very nice. I'd love to like speak with him and interview him at some point.
Unless he hears this,
otherwise he'll never want to.
And also, that
meet
was his
ever.
Son recently cast in that King Arthur movie.
Yes,
that's right.
I just
the kid who would be king.
That was actually pretty decent.
It was grand. Yeah. It was like a nice kind of family romp, you know,
a real romp. I'm gonna start saving that for actual romps.
So we interviewed. I sat down with Gurinder Chowda, who is the director of Blinded by Light. We talked about, obviously, Bruce Springsteen. We talked about directing a musical, but not really a musical. We talked about Pride and Prejudice. We talked about Bend It Like Beckham, all her movies. And this was a really, really cool interview. I'm really proud of how it went. So have a listen. I guess the first question I wanted to ask you was with regards to Blinded by the Light. I mean, I was watching it and I felt that there was kind of similarities between, you know, Pride and Prejudice and Bend It Like Beckham, in the sense of that you had...
you know, a young character, but there was very much a sense of their feelings were valid. You know,
yes.
That kind of way?
Yes.
How do you kind of go about that in terms of directing that for the actor? I mean, is it a case of, do you just try to speak to them on their level? I mean, what do you do to kind of bring that out of the performance?
Well, I think in the case of Bender Like Beckham, but also Pride and Prejudice, the actor knows that world,
yeah.
You know, being Asian. They know that world of wanting to do things that they want to do, dreams that they have, and knowing that their parents might not follow
want
those
for them.
Dreams
yeah,
and
yeah,
want
yeah.
for them, but that their parents also have their own dreams, you yeah. know. And so I think there is this sense of duty, you know, how you deal with duty. And I think with when I come to direct these scenes, you know, I put a lot of myself in it and my own position for them as well. And what I always get to, well, try and get to as a director is the truth. You know,
yeah.
So for the actor, the character and what they're going through has to feel truthful
yeah.
For them to play it. Otherwise, it feels like acting.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, just that you say that it feels like acting, because when you look at, again, when you look at Blinded by the Light, there is that sense of it's really, really earnest. I mean, and I guess my question is that when you're watching it, I mean, are you as a director, you're obviously going for that, yeah? You're obviously
yes.
going for that kind of, we want this to be not wholesome is not the right word, but we want this
truthful.
Truthful, yeah. We want this to feel truthful. We want this to feel earnest, and there's no sense of cynicism about it, and there's no sense of anything, yeah.
Well, I think the fact that it's a true story
yeah.
is important. Vivek, who plays Javed, got to spend a lot of time with Safraz, who the story is based on. And, you know, I think when you're playing someone who's still alive,
yeah.
you know, it's a difficult one
it is,
because
isn't
you're
it?
Kind of having to sort of honour them being alive, but at the same time...
Be truthful to your own performance, yeah.
Yes, and but we were also honouring Bruce Springsteen so and his legacy. So there was that sense of authenticity and truth as well. So even though the actor had never really heard Bruce Springsteen before...
Really?
No.
Jesus.
So he listens to rap. So we were
rap?
Like,
well, hang on. He only listened to rap.
Yes, yes.
And he had no foreknowledge of...
No.
And Jesus.
I had to slap him around quite
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, good, okay.
And in the audition, one of the things I made the actors do in the audition, and I told them this, you're going to read two scenes and then you're going to dance to Born to Run, you know. And that was the thing that all the actors hated.
Yeah.
Because I'd put the song on and I'd go, okay, now...
Off your pop.
Yeah, as a fan, what would you do, you know? And Vivek did a brilliant thing. He put headphones on.
Right.
And he closed his eyes because he didn't know what else to do. But he closed his eyes as if he was really lost in the music. And so he sold it.
That's good, yeah. That's clever, yeah.
Yeah, whereas other people were quite self-conscious about it, you know. But I think that... For me, you know, that's what's so great about working with actors, and I've kind of worked with quite a lot of young actors
yeah.
and broken quite a few into, you know,
definitely.
Into stardom. And I think that working with raw talent and bringing that sense of innocence and truth, I think that's what you're getting at.
That's innocence. That's exactly
it's
the word.
Innocence,
yeah.
isn't
yeah.
it? And because there's something very alluring about being an innocent kid about to go into a cynical world.
Yeah.
And hoping that they keep that sense of innocence somehow as they go into that coming of age, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, when I was watching this, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that thing of innocence, because you wouldn't, I mean, I love Bruce Springsteen, but I wouldn't call his music innocent at all. Like,
no.
And that's my point, is that, like, his music is very much... You know, in the real world, and it's
absolutely.
Tough as shit, and
yes.
it's really fucking grabbing this stuff.
No,
like,
he's but, not. Oh, you swore? Is that allowed?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. But well, like, I mean, sorry, did it offend? I mean,
no, I've been wanting to swear, but I'm like being very polite.
No, you're fine. Go for it. Fuck, who cares?
It's Bruce Springsteen's music is not innocent, but what it is in its own way, it has a sense of innocence, because it's about why is life such a struggle?
Yeah.
Why can't life be simpler?
Mm.
Why do I have to struggle through this life? You know, and as he's grown older, you know, his early music is about escaping and trying to find
the river and all that kind of thing, and the idea of getting away, and
yes, and that life is hard, you know. And that's the River Song. I mean, life is hard, you know. It's about teenage pregnancy and having to get married. But I think that what we're seeing in Bruce now is someone who's coming to terms with the fact that, yes, life is a struggle, but within it there are moments. There are your promised land moments. And find those moments and cherish those moments.
Mm.
And I think that that's what's innocent and simple.
Yeah, at the core of it, yeah.
At the core of it, yeah.
I presume you've screened this film for him. What's he made of it?
So he obviously approved.
Of course,
me doing it. And then when I went to New York to show him my cut, the idea was that he would see what I had done and had an opportunity to change it if he wanted to, because it was my cut.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was very nerve-wracking. I sat in the small room with his managers and put the movie on, and he was watching it like a hawk.
Yeah.
And then there are some self-deprecating jokes in it. He loved those. He laughed at those. And at the very end, there was silence. So I thought, oh, my God.
What have I done?
What have I done? I've got to go home. And I put the lights on, and he got up, and he walked over to me, and he gave me a big kiss and a hug, and he said, thank you for looking after me so beautifully. Wow.
That's really good.
And then he said, don't change a thing. I love it.
That's probably, yeah, because I was going to say, because not that he's concerned with his image as such, but no. I would think of him as a person he's very careful. He makes very, very smart decisions about what he puts his name to and what he gets involved with.
Yes.
So I guess with something like this, this was a vote of confidence.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the vote of confidence came also from the fact that he'd read Safraz's book.
Yeah.
You know, so he knew this was a very authentic story. I think also, you know, it's a story about a father and a son, which is something that obviously
he has a lot of resonance with. Yeah.
A lot of resonance. And when we were writing our script, he'd just written his movie. So there were parallels, obviously, for him. And then his Broadway show, which we hadn't seen when we wrote our script, but there are huge similarities.
Very.
So I think it was an area that he was exploring himself. And I think he just probably just liked the idea of exploring it through a Pakistani kid as well.
Yeah.
It has a ring of authenticity.
It does, it does.
And that's the thing about Bruce, is Bruce is not... He didn't see himself as a superstar.
No.
And Tracy Nurse, his manager, who's also an executive producer on the film, she has her whole career, 30 years of working with Bruce. She has to go to gigs wherever he is appearing and go and take down anything that makes him look like a rock star. If anyone's put a sign up that says, welcome to the boss or whatever, she has to say, you've got to take that down. He doesn't want anything that makes him feel grand or makes him look grand. He's very down to earth. And if you look at his philosophy, I mean, his big statement is nobody wins unless we all win. He's a man of the people, and he likes to keep it that way.
It's almost socialist, isn't it, in a way? Like, it is.
Well,
like,
he's a Democrat, right?
Well, Democratic socialist, yeah.
Yes.
Or sorry, socialist, social democrat, yeah, sorry.
Yes, in the States. And in some ways, you know, I think approving this film for us was amazingly smart for him as a Democrat, because this film has ended up by conveying his values on America and on life, has ended up being a very feel-good film for America at this time.
It's a reaffirmation, yes.
It's a reaffirmation of a sort of nostalgic vision of America, but what America stands for. And with a lot of people who feel that politically they're not being represented at the moment, it's Bruce's words and values that are resonating. So it's made him very, very relevant again. And that was, we learned that at Sundance in January. We didn't know several months later he was going to release an album that was going to be number one all over, you know, so many countries world. I had no idea about this album. So it's all sort of, you know, come together.
Even that as well, like the album itself, like I've listened to it, like it's funny that that album is nostalgic about the old West and America. Yes. And then this, of course, as you say, ties in with that sense of nostalgia.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, with regards, you just mentioned there that it was your cut. Did you make more cuts after that, or was there just...
We made a few changes, but really good ones.
Right.
You know, everything I did was I wanted to do, and they were just improvements.
Yeah.
You know, there were moments, there were places that were very funny, scenes that were funny. So I had cut some of the funniness out. So I put some of the humor back in, i.e. with Eliza's parents.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I put some humor back in that.
Yeah, like Marcus Brigstocke in that scene was hilarious.
Very funny.
Isn't he? Like, very he's funny. Such a good talent. Like,
yeah, I added the bit at the beginning about garlic bread. That kind of wasn't there before.
No. It makes sense, though.
And it was very funny.
It is, isn't it?
And there were other moments where I thought I could do things a bit better.
Yeah.
And slicker. And so I did that. And just better cuts, really.
One question I wanted to ask, because I would imagine, you know, obviously you had Bruce's, you know, interest and his, you know, blessing to make this and what have you. I would guess, you know, there's an element of you could basically put any song you wanted in. You could probably put it in for as long as you want. But I would guess you've got to be kind of economical with it in the sense of, like, if we just play the whole fucking 9 minutes of Born to Run, it's going to take up 9 minutes of the movie. So I guess my question for you is what was your... Was there any criteria? Was it just you wanted the chorus? Did you want a particular line? I mean, I know you have that scene in it where the lines come up on the wall and stuff. Yes,
well, it was very careful. I mean, every song I used was like part of my script. You know, it's just part of the narrative.
Yeah.
So every lyric, every bit of song that's selected is because the lyrics make sense. And I had to forget that Bruce Springsteen existed as an artist before this film, because I had to make every song feel like it was written for me and this movie. So those were my decisions on choosing the songs. And then within that, I chose little sections of them, and where bits weren't relevant, I did this thing where I had him fast forward the Walkman.
Yeah, you know, to clever, the relevant clever. Bit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But ultimately, I only... There were other songs of his I love. One of my favourite songs of his is Sherry Darling, Off the River album. And he does an amazing acoustic version of that, a slower version, as well as the album version. But there was no way I could use that song.
You couldn't fit it in. Yeah.
So I was quite, you know, strict about it. But there were moments where when you take music like this, see, I didn't want it to be a jukebox album, album or old film. I needed it to be integral to the film. So when you do that, the sum of all the music has to add up to something else.
Yeah.
And by selecting the pieces that I did, I think what it's done is made people re-listen to Bruce and realize actually what he was saying then and what he's saying now is still the same and that it's even more relevant today. And I think that's been a great thing for me, is people have said, oh yeah, Bruce, but wow, we never really listened to him.
Yeah.
And now we're listening to him. And I think that in my choice of songs, I did end up using all the ones that I thought were important to use. One of the songs I really wanted to use was Darkness on the Edge of Town, but I couldn't find a place to use it in the script. But it was in the back of my head. And then one day in the middle of the shoot, we were shooting a scene that's written in the script as an argument between the father and the son, about the dad saying, I want you to give up this music.
Yeah.
You know, get on with studying and get, and then let's get you a proper job, like an estate agent, you know. And when I was in the room and they were rehearsing, I was like, okay, I feel this scene is repetitive. We know what the dad's going to say.
Yeah.
And I called the production designer over and I said, right, I want to cut a hole in the set here. And they were like, are you mad? Like, this is bedroom. What do you mean? And I said, trust me. So we're going to cut a hole here. We'll be able to cover it with a map of the world.
Of course, yeah.
But cut a hole and I'm going to have the camera on a track and I'm going to have the camera coming in, tracking very slowly. So we'll start the scene with the dad having a go at him. But as the scene carries on, I'm going to drown out the dad and I'm going to play Darkness on the Edge of Town. And everyone thought I'd gone mad
because
I was cutting the setup. But I knew that that's how to use that song, and that's exactly what I did. So I shot the scene very differently to how one would have done it, as written. And that was just to get Darkness on the Edge of Town in.
Into it.
And I think that scene works.
Yeah.
Beautifully. I love that, you know, because it's like is Bruce saying, you know, you've got, everybody's got a secret, son, you know, but someday you've got to cut loose. Don't let them drag you down.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's the dad's going, oh, I'm not saying do this. And the dad is getting drowned out. And Bruce is talking to him and saying, don't let them drag you down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that was a very exciting moment for me as a director on set where I kind of thought, oh, yes, I can make this
That's
work.
It, isn't it? When you get that moment, you're like, fuck, I've got it. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Get out the scissors. We're going to do this.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Very exciting. And there was a few of those. There's a big epiphany scene, as I call it, where he first listens to Bruce on the night of the hurricane that we had in England in 1987. That's right, and that is where he first really appreciates Bruce. And I knew that if I didn't get that right, I didn't have a movie.
Yeah.
No one would believe it.
It rests on that, yeah.
It totally rested on that. And that took me a long time to get that right. Lots of editing, lots of fiddling. And now it looks effortless, but it wasn't. It was really hard work.
Yeah.
I went through lots of different cuts you know, to get there. But finally, I was happy with what I got. And it's a remarkable scene to watch with Bruce Springsteen, you know, like in that cinema there, because it's words that he wrote about himself trying to escape New Jersey and realizing that life is hard. But you've got to find your promised land. So, because it's Dancing in the Dark and Promised Land. He would have written them in a particular context in New Jersey as that kid, in the 70s. So watching it back with him, here's a 16-year-old Muslim Pakistani kid.
In 1987 or whenever it was.
Yeah, and the words mean something to him and help him find his mojo in that moment. You know, it's very powerful stuff. And it's about, you know, how music and the right music, when heard,
can hit you.
Hit you.
Yeah.
And change your life.
Yeah. I have a final question now, and just because I know we're tight for time. What is your favorite Bruce Springsteen song? And I'll tell you mine. Mine is Tougher Than the Rest.
Is it?
Mine is Tougher Than the Rest. I love Tougher Than the Rest.
Well, I have to say, I have two go-to Springsteen's albums.
All right.
One is Ghost of Tom Joad.
Yeah.
Really love that album.
Yeah.
Jonestown.
Yeah.
Love that. And I have a lot of respect for The Rising, the track The Rising, because I thought that was the most eloquent response to 9/11 that I saw from anyone. I love, love, love his Live in Dublin album, because it's so joyful. And the way the audience is interacting with him blows my mind.
Yeah.
And I love it that he just lets the audience sing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I love Further Up the Road in that. And he's singing with a beautiful Irish singer.
Yeah, that was
Further Up the Road, Further Up the Road.
I'm trying to remember who that was now.
Gonna meet you further up the road. I mean, that song is haunting. And the way it's sung as a duet with that.
Yeah.
Shall I go on? There's quite a lot.
No. Give me, okay, tell you what, give me a deep cut album track that you love. Give me a deep cut album track. Just give me one. Because you can't use, because if you were going to go, like, live performances, well, then I'd go with The River off the, you know, the one that he did in Coliseum.
I think Darkness.
Yeah?
I think Darkness on the Edge of Town is an amazing song.
Isn't it?
For atmosphere, for conjuring up that sense of isolation, of feeling like you're the only one that feels like this, and then you know, when the big sound comes in, that sense of anger and frustration, and someone begging you to cut loose, and you know, I mean, I think that's an amazing,
you can feel
track.
It can't yeah. you can yeah. feel
you
it
you can like, feel it, it's visceral.
Yeah.
He talks to you, you know.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah. He talks to you.
Yeah, that's it. Because when I listen, like, the one for me is Tougher Than the Rest. Like, you can really feel that this character, like, it's not even him, but this character that he's made, you can feel that he's broken down. He's like, if you don't want anybody else, baby, I'm tougher than the rest. Like, that sense of, like, that yearning. Like, you can feel it, even though it's...
Yearning's a great word for him. That's it. You know, so much of his music is about yearning for some meaning in life.
Yeah.
You know, something that's going to make him feel.
Yeah.
You know, and that, And that's when you start looking at that, you understand that this is a man that's dealt with depression for so much of his life. Because when you're depressed, you can't feel anything.
Mm.
And so here is these beautiful songs that are yearning for feeling and emotion.
That's really interesting. Okay, we have to leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank what you. A pleasure.
Not at all. So Blinded by the Light.
Yes.
You didn't get to see this, did you?
No, and I really wanted to because I really like her movies. Like, I really love Bend It Like Beckham.
Yeah.
I like Angus Long's Perfect Snogging. I wasn't mad about Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
It was just very kind of a lot for
yes.
me. But
even
no,
like
really
Bend It Like Beckham
like
is one of the movies I've seen more than any other film.
There you go.
Really? Yeah.
Why is that? Like, I do remember it being on telly a lot.
Yeah.
That
I think just that. And then I think my sister got a copy of it on DVD. Or VHS, probably DVD, I don't know. But that was like...
Always on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is crazy when you think about only now that you have a bit more context that she was trying to reach out to redefine English culture or whatever.
Completely.
And I was just there like, oh, girls can't play football.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Like it's very, you know, the thing that I found about Bend It Like Beckham and Pride and Prejudice and Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging is that... And this is something that we talked about in the interview, is the idea of, like, is it innocent? Is it earnest? And is it too much? Like, you know, that kind of way.
Sure.
And that is a problem, I think, that you might get with Blinded by the Light, because it's very earnest.
It's saccharine, like.
It could be construed that way. Yeah, it definitely could. Like, it really is a big kind of wear its heart on its sleeve kind of film. And that's it. Yeah, no, it is. Like, it really, really is that. And the more I kind of thought about it, initially, I'll freely admit, initially I walked out of Blinded by the Light and I was like, oh, that's just too much. Like, that's just, no, I don't like this at all.
Can you give us the synopsis?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So it's based on the sort of autobiography of Guardian journalist Safraz Manzoor. He was this Pakistani first-generation guy in Luton. He had a very kind of tumultuous relationship with his father, who worked in a Ford plant,
right,
and then was laid off.
Oh.
And this was obviously in the 80s in Thatcher Britain. So you had like people like the NF, the National Front, like beating the crap out of Pakistani people.
Yeah. Mm.
And also as well was just the general kind of, you know, unemployment and the terrible economic conditions in England at the time. And he kind of found solace in Bruce Springsteen. Like, he like listened to all his albums and really kind of connected and understood what was coming from Bruce Springsteen's upbringing to how it connected to his life. In the fact that, like, you know, Bruce Springsteen famously had a really tumultuous relationship with his father, and he felt the same with his own father. And the idea of, like, just desperately trying to get out of Luton, or in Springsteen's case, getting out of New Jersey. And when I first watched the film, I was like, that's way too saccharine. That's just way too earnest. Like, it's too much. Mm. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, well, actually, no. Like, Bruce Springsteen's stuff is really hard on its sleeve.
You're not a fan of Springsteen, are you, Brian?
And I don't think that I've mentioned this before, but I guess I kind
Explain
of am.
Explain to the people at home whether or not you're right now.
I am. I'm a massive Bruce Springsteen fan. And in fact, Dave O'Regan, producer Dave, regularly slags me about liking Bruce Springsteen.
Because he's a man of the people.
Him. Yeah.
And yet he's a billionaire.
Yeah, like, because producer Dave's argument against Bruce Springsteen was
that, I don't know if he believes the argument.
Because it really pisses me off. He's all like, ah, yeah, he's just going to charge everyone 80 quid to go see him. And he think he's the champion of the working man and all this kind of stuff. And
Brian eats that shit for breakfast.
I know,
in fairness.
Just, like, and that just, like, it's just like tinfoil on teeth. I just can't not, like, bite at it. Like, I'm not gonna... But, no.
It's weird as well that a movie like this is coming out, I would think, quite close to Yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday is kind
that
of similar.
That was the original vibe I got.
Yeah.
And it's similar as well, that, like, it's a Asian, you know, Asian English
person.
Yeah,
exactly. Kind of, yeah. Find an identity as well. Like,
yeah, find an identity and all that kind of stuff.
Was it easy to draw those parallels between his work and, like, the blue-collarness of
Springsteen? Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, that's it. Completely. Like, that's it. Like, you can really see why somebody would connect so fully with Bruce Springsteen's music. Like, it's done very, very well. You can totally see why somebody would be inspired by it. That being said, you know, there are some parts of it where it's like literally they're running down the street to
Born to Run, like, you know, that kind of way. Like, it's very obvious in parts. Like,
yeah.
And it can be that kind of thing of like, oh, that's a bit much. Like,
you see behind the curtain a little bit. You feel
a little
like...
bit, a little bit. It's a bit like, oh, like you're really hammering it here.
Yeah,
like,
you know? Yeah.
But again, like I think the intent is never cynical. It's not cynical at all. Yeah. That's what I would say about this film. If you have even the
that sounds like a real romp.
No, but it is. But like, no, honestly, like if you go into it with any kind of cynicism or skepticism, sure, you're gonna hate it. Like, you kind of have to really take it at face value. You really have to be open-hearted about it, like, in order to enjoy it, like, and you will enjoy it, like, if you like.
Someone will definitely get something out of that.
Oh, Jesus, completely.
After a long week.
No, honestly, it's, if you're a Bruce Springsteen fan, you're going to love it. Like, yeah, you really, really are, like, because I saw it at Radio Nova did a screening for it, and it was all full. It was around the time when his new album Western Stars was out, and it was like a listening party slash premiere.
Oh, aww, class.
That's nice.
And everyone in the room were Bruce Springsteen fans, and they were like roaring.
It's the right audience.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, completely. Like, and that really sells it. Like, yeah, when you see it with people who love it, who love Bruce Springsteen, they're going to get as much out of it as anybody. Yes. Like. So I enjoyed it, but like, just be conscious of the fact that, like,
how earnest it is.
Like, good, but again, like, if you've watched any of her films, if you've watched Bend It Like Beckham,
yes,
or Bride and Prejudice, or Angus Thongs and Perfect Song, and or whatever, you know, it's wholesome. It's very wholesome. It's very, very earnest.
Because there's a thing that this reminded me of, where I will watch any movie set in the north of England, like, you know, all that kind of Thatcherite stuff, even like Billy Elliot.
Yeah,
This Is England, but. There was a moment when I was watching Pride. Do you remember Pride?
Yeah, I loved Pride.
It was really good. But it too was, you know, pretty wholesome at the end of the day. And I think it might have been the third time it happened in the film or something, where I was just so sick of them like switching what you expect, norms on the head, where it's like, you gays make me sick with worry at the way you've been mistreated. Can I do some backpacking for you or whatever? It's like, yeah, get out of this town and down to the nearest hotel where we're putting you up for the night. It's always like,
there is one, I will say,
they hold out their hand for a handshake. Yeah, and you're like,
yeah, there is one scene like that in Blinded by the Light. It's like the next door neighbor. It's like, oh God, he's going to be racist. And it's like, nope, he's not.
Yeah.
It's such a thing.
He's
though,
holding a Pakistani flag. And
something, it's not as that, but it's very like, oh, you know, like, it's like, okay. It's like, I know, like, I'm very happy that you're like, that you've done this, but just once, like, lean off the cliche, just once, you know, that kind of way. Oh no, it's an older man. I bet he's going to be racist. No, he's not.
Yeah.
Fool on you for thinking Superman that he's a racist. Yeah.
And what did you give it at the end of the day?
Oh no, I'd give it like 3.5 out of 5. It was James Anderson wrote the review for the site.
Oh, brilliant.
And he gave 3.5 out of 5, and I'd agree with that.
Really,
it's
solid.
Yeah, it's very solid. It's a very, very solid musical. It's very enjoyable.
Brilliant.
a real romp. I need to talk to you though, Deirdre, about The Art of the Racing in the Rain.
Oh, I thought we were doing animals next, but we can do Art of Racing. Brian's ruining my schedule today. We can do The Art of Racing in the Rain first. This is fresh in my mind because I saw it this morning. But what were you going to ask, Brian?
Okay, I read somewhere online that this is about a reincarnated dog.
It's not quite a reincarnated dog, but reincarnation does come into it. So it's basically like the whole dogs and existentialism thing, like we've already seen in A Dog's Purpose, and its sequel, A Dog's Journey. So it's like...
Is it very similar to those two?
It's quite similar. Yeah, it's just very weird.
Just in spirit?
Like, it's like a dog basically does the voiceover narration. So you're like in the dog's head.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner, by the way.
Oh, such a nice man who would do something like this.
He totally would. Go on. Anyway.
So like the opening scene, and this isn't giving it away because literally the opening scene is the dog is like old and sick and lying on the ground.
I knew it.
And then the whole film is basically, Brian already looks upset. His head is in his hands. I don't know if he's going to cry or if he's so sick of this shit. I genuinely can't tell. But in any case, and then the whole film is a flashback of him looking back over his life with his owner from when he was first, you know, adopted from a farm to this moment at the end of his life.
Okay.
So Yeah, it stars Milo Ventimiglia. I don't know how to pronounce this. Ventimiglia. Thank you.
Yeah. Racist.
I look at his surname and I'm like, how do you pronounce that? But he plays this like race car driver. And essentially the film kind of follows his lifetime in that Milo like meets a woman, falls in love. They decide to have a family together, okay. Go through all the motions. Eventually there's a family tragedy at some point. So, you know, they're trying to get you to kind of be, you know, they're trying to be as tear-jerking
and tone as
possible.
But how close to Nicholas Sparks does it get? Is it that?
It's not so much Nicholas Sparks as it is like A Dog's Purpose. It really is like those films all over again. And I'm like,
it's almost as if the people who saw those films saw the money those films made.
Yeah. It's just, how are we getting so many of these films? Like, look, I love dogs, but I don't look at a dog and I think, I wonder what he's thinking about life right now. Or I don't think like, you know, what kind of philosophical thoughts are going through the mind of my dog right now. Yeah. I don't think those things. Do other people think these things? I don't
understand.
What's
the ultimate dog movie then? If you had to make one from scratch, it's just...
John Wick.
Yeah.
You know what? I actually do think John Wick is the perfect dog movie with that whole, you know, with poor Daisy at the start. And then that ending is so perfect when he gets the new dog at the end. No,
silence.
John Wick is like the perfect... Yeah, because a lot of dog movies I find are like too sad and they're almost kind of trying to manipulate a reaction out of it. And I know that John Wick does have a dog death, but then you see the likes of, you know, My Dog Skip and Marley and Me. And it's like it always has to end with the death of the dog.
Yes.
Or in the case of A Dog's Purpose and other films, apparently now the new thing is to end with the dog reincarnated.
Of course.
It's just very
strange. It passes on so that nobody has to feel guilty about
anything. Exactly, because it's alive somewhere else. Apparently, I won't even give it away with this film, but it's weird. It's not quite confirmed at the end that the dog is reincarnated, but it's implied and it's a weird implication. So yeah, I won't get into it, but this is a very strange film. I think that families will like it, and I suppose, see, you've got the dogs in there for the kids.
Yes.
You've got the whole race car driving aspect for the dads.
Wow.
You've got the melodramatic, and I know I'm being like totally generalizing and mildly sexist here, but you've got the whole melodramatic family story for the women in the audience. Like I said, I'm being really broad here, so don't like write into me giving out. I'm just saying this is where, you know,
shame on
this
you,
is what
Deirdre.
They invest in to get in
way
all
to
the
say,
families.
Way
and
to say your gender back, Deirdre.
Okay, but in any case, like I can see why like families would
yes.
like this and stuff. But I mean, it's weird. It's a weird movie.
I love it. I love that this has become a thing.
Like A Dog's Purpose was kind of weird enough, but I got on board with it because like it genuinely did give me the feels. It did. I'm sorry.
But
it
this
cracked
is the thing.
Into my soul.
If any of us were weakened enough and we came across this, would we crumble underneath it?
The thing is like, because I've seen A Dog's Purpose and like I haven't seen A Dog's Journey, but I'd be aware of it. And I know that this is just rehashing the same formula. Like I can't shake that cynicism. So I suppose if you haven't seen either of those films, so you wouldn't be familiar with that formula, then this would definitely.
Or if you haven't listened to this and realized it's all a cynical moneymaker.
I mean, the dog is fantastically trained. I actually wrote an article over the weekend. You can see it on site. It's how to make your dog a movie star. And but I mean, all the effort that goes into training dogs for movies, like you don't actually realize the extent of it. And, you know, all the different kind of, you know, tricks and stuff. And they have to be like individually taught to the dog and stuff. It's not like you just, you know, raise your dog to be really well trained and to do whatever the heck you want
it to
be.
It has to be uber specific or whatever.
Yeah. And it behaves differently around different actors and in different settings and all of this stuff. Like, it's really fascinating. The dog was excellent in it, may I just say.
Oh.
Or it may have been dogs, because sometimes they use multiple ones, but the dog was fabulous.
If only there was an article we could read more about.
Well, wait, there is.
On one brilliant website. Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting as well, because I was talking to someone from Faircroft Animal Actors and hearing about how it relates to the Irish industry specifically, because there are only really so many film and TV productions that are made here. So it's slightly different here compared to when you have like animal training in other countries.
But they would still request a local dog.
Yeah, or they want like a really specific like breed of dog and stuff like this, as opposed to like compared to say like the John Wick dogs, they would have come from like a kennel in the States. So those are like dogs that are all held there in that kennel and you almost kind of rent them out for the day or whatever. But with Anna, yes. But with Ireland, because like there are so few productions going on and such specific requests, like I want a grey and white husky or whatever, usually they have to go out and actually source them. So that's why it's actually almost more likely that your pet could become an actor here than say elsewhere. So that's why it's worth reading my article and learning more about it.
Wow. Get yourself into the dog raising movie.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Celeb community.
And the thing is, like, the chances are it'll only get one or two jobs, but you can always say, there's my dog in that ad or poster campaign or movie or TV show or whatever.
Oh my God.
You'll
amazing.
Always have that. You'll always have, there's my has dog immortalized.
Than us. Yeah.
No, definitely.
Wait, were you ever in an ad, were you?
No.
Oh. Yeah. Do you ever do like a TV? Do you ever do like extra work? Like
no, but for a short time on the radio, I was the voice of your local credit union.
Oh, wow. Were That's really? A cool gig.
Pop I could totally see to that in you.
Like you do have a radio you voice.
I just do a voice of I impersonate someone who would do a radio ad, and that's how I do it.
That's amazing.
There you go.
I was an extra in the clinic.
Oh my yeah. God, I should have asked.
Like, yeah, it was like literally like 2 seconds. You could just like see me walking in the background. It's just like, I was told, like I was in college and it was like, I just needed the money. And it was like, oh, yeah, it was like, oh yeah, get 200 quid. And
did like, you have a backstory?
Oh yeah, 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 no, yeah, or... yeah. Like there was the girl that I had to do the scene with, she was really like, she was like Gaiety School of Acting. And she was like, so we're talking and like, you know, I feel like I'm having a very intense conversation with you. And I was like, literally just like, yeah, all right, yeah, cool.
I will be the man who stands here.
I'm going to be the man smoking because we're outside and you're allowed to smoke on sets at the time. That's how I'll tell you how long.
Oh, wow.
I was just like, they were like, oh, yeah, cool, yeah.
So you
yeah.
just had, so you loved the gig because it just gave you an excuse to have however many exactly, cigarettes, yeah, depending
yeah,
on
and
the
I had to keep
stakes.
Lighting them as well because they were sick. Continuity. Yeah.
Oh, you could have collapsed.
Oh, no, you told, like, and just kept bringing me coffee as well because I kept drinking it. Perfect. It was paying like €200 for like literally like sitting smoking and drinking coffee for like 3 hours. Nice. Fantastic. Best job I ever had. You did stuff though, didn't you?
Oh, you were in the Princess Diaries.
No, she was auditioned.
No, I wasn't.
She auditioned.
Sorry, is on
I didn't
sore
get
spot.
The part.
No.
No, it's fine. Like I did some like ads and stuff when I was little, but that's it.
Are they online?
Are they online?
No, probably not. It was mostly like poster ads as opposed to like TV
God.
Commercials.
Did you have any of them?
So, yeah.
These are the questions I want answered.
No, it doesn't matter.
I'm totally going to find this out.
Yeah, we're going to go
like here.
No. I genuinely don't think there were any TV ads. It was all like poster stuff.
I used to work with a girl.
I did a few for the Smiths catalog. I was on the cover once.
Oh my God. I think I probably have old Smiths catalogs.
Like, guys, I was like 7. So this
That's
was a
amazing.
Long time ago.
I'll just stop the research. It's fine. You can please show us. But
please show us.
If you don't,
I'll try to find it.
Anyway, I believe you.
We've detracted again, which is so.
Speaking of
us.
Coming of age,
nice.
That was excellent.
Nice.
Yes. New film is called Animals. Someone else do the rest of the work.
Because you know
for
what
me.
I was thinking. I was thinking you could segue from Animals to Art of Racing in the Rain because the dog. So that's what I had in my head. But actually, I like yours better.
I like that you're pre-segueing for my mind as you order the running order for the
show.
I
was genuinely trying to think, what would Owen be thinking? Trying to get into your mind?
You know, we'll never know whether or not I would have got there. No, we will. I wouldn't have got there. I would not have been able to go, animals, dogs.
No, I like the way you did it. Yeah. But this is the one. So we had an interview with Sophie Hyde last week. So you can listen to last week's podcast if you want to hear that interview. I thought it was very good. Brian
very
actually
good
complimented
yeah, I thought
it
was
me
really
for
good interview.
It. And I never get a compliment from Brian. So it must be good. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Right.
But it's I really, really like this film. It's about these two girls. They're kind of, I think they're meant to be 29 and 31. So they're like that bit older or whatever.
Yeah.
And they just love partying.
They're our age. What are you talking about? Older. They're
no,
our
as
age.
In like.
Brian, you are older than the Christ. All right. You are almost 34.
My point is for this being a coming of age film.
Sure.
But that's kind of like the point of it as well. Anyway, they're always like partying, drinking, doing drugs. They live together. And
you might say they're in a state of arrested development. Oh!
Maybe.
That was very good. the actress from Arrested Development. Yes! Yeah! Alia Shawkat, who's fabulous in this. Holiday Granger's in it too. I really liked her in it. Holiday Granger is kind of the main girl. Her name is Laura, I think, in this. But she basically meets this guy called Jim, really likes him, starts to go out with him, moves in with him. So she's starting to kind of go down the kind of traditional life route, yes, I suppose, she's for a woman.
Got some growing up to do.
Yeah, but like Alia Shawkat's character is constantly pulling her back to like the partying ways. And in fairness, like she loves both. So she kind of feels like a bit torn in her lifestyle at the moment. And even like Laura has this sister who like used to go out with the girls and like party all the time and would like strip on bars and stuff like this. But she's now like settled down and she has like a kid and stuff, but she's not totally satisfied with the life she chose either. So I think that it's a really interesting reflection on like friendship and on like kind of modernist living, I suppose, because like, and I mean, this doesn't just apply to
how slow we're all growing up, basically.
Yeah. And it's kind of a thing that applies to men and women, but I think that especially for women, like, even though not everything's perfect, we do have more choices than ever before, and we're not kind of judged with the way we want to live our life. For the most part, there will always be people who will judge us, but like, I just find it really interesting that in terms of like this character, she has more choices than ever. And as a result, she's almost more confused than ever. So I thought that that was really interesting. And I really loved the wardrobes in this film. I know I mentioned this last week as well, but like the clothes these girls wear, absolutely amazing. And just the like Alia Shawkat and Holiday Granger are amazing in it. They're having so much fun making this movie that you just end up kind of smiling and laughing as if you're going along for the ride or the romp with them. So I really enjoyed this film. I thought that it was really interesting the way the events kind of end up turning and where the story goes and everything.
And is it very much like, is it, how does it contrast with something like Booksmart?
It's completely different to Booksmart. Like really in terms of comparison, and I would agree with her because the director actually mentioned this, but it's more like With Nail and I kind of style.
Okay,
I would say
right.
Because it's like, because that film was kind of about two male friends just going on the lash together, and it's similar with this.
Yes,
like this one has slightly more of a story, I would say, than With Nail and I.
Yes.
But yeah, that's
where
with
Booksmart,
specifically,
I was thinking of the kind of Odyssey aspect of it, where it's kind of like
Booksmart, I would think of
it
more
was kind of
kind
set
of,
over one night, really.
It was kind of more high school type setting, that one would be.
Yes.
Like I would compare that more, and I know that, you know, they're like, it's not super bad, but it is very super bad.
It
or
is.
Mean Girls or one of those ones.
Absolutely.
As opposed to this one. Yeah, like I said, With Nail and I and those kind of films would be more of a comparison point.
I heard there was some sort of thing about the accents in it, that the accents that Holiday Granger and Alia Shawkat did weren't great because they were doing Dublin accents.
So
are they meant to be from
Dublin? No, Alia Shawkat's character isn't from Dublin, but Holiday Granger's character is. So she does do a Dublin accent. I thought it was fine, but then again, I don't know. I don't think I'm as sensitive to Irish movies.
You're from the South
Side, Dean.
No, but I hear people like giving out about kind of Irish accents in movies all the time, and I'll hear them and I'll be like, I don't think it's that
bad. They did
their
best. Yeah.
I thought they did.
I think
okay.
We'd nitpick no matter how well.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, see, the thing is, the film was originally like, and the original book is set in Manchester, and the film was originally going to be in Manchester. And again, me and the director talk all about this, and then they decided to make it in Dublin, and it ended up being like a co-production with Ireland and everything. So she actually approached Holiday and said, "How do you feel about, you know, doing an Irish accent?" And her parents in the film actually are played by, Pat Short and Olwen Fuhrer. I also So I mean, again, in terms of like accent and influence, like these are all completely different parts of Ireland.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Yeah. That was terrible, Pat Short. Yeah. Sorry, Pat.
Pat's lovely,
and how,
by the way.
How much does Dublin come out of it? Which is all I ever want to know in films.
I actually thought that it was a really kind of beautiful portrayal of the city and a really good capturing of like Dublin nightlife, which is another aspect of it I really enjoyed. So just generally,
how does it compare to Dublin Old School then?
Oh, like
the last synonym.
It's different because Dublin Old School is more about kind of the grungy, like DJ club kind of scenes, whereas this is almost like more the wine clubs, which we were talking about earlier, actually, kind of bars and wine clubs kind
of. We were talking about DJ grunge scenes.
No, we were talking about wine clubs, remember?
We were talking about this off air. So, like, anyone listening to this, we're like, we never once mentioned wine bars.
Okay, but in any case,
we did talk about how.
Yeah,
we're
talking about how cool the class DJs are.
Class A's are.
In any case, they're kind of different scenes, I would say. And then I suppose there's also the fact that the character of Jim, who's the boyfriend in it, like, he comes from this real kind of classic pianist background. So at one point they go to like this event and it's really funny because they're giving out free wine and the girls are just like chugging down the free wine and everyone is going around in like these really formal dresses and it's this kind of big like white hall and then he like plays the piano in it and they're just chugging down the glasses and they're like kind of short, you know, like sequin dresses. Everyone there is in ball gowns kind of like sipping at the wine. It's really funny. But it shows like different, you know, sides to Dublin and then hanging out in apartments and stuff like that. So
I will check that out. Yeah. I genuinely will. What was your final?
I think I'm trying to remember now. Did I give it 3.5 or 4? But a good one.
Yeah.
But Dublin Old School, actually, yeah, I'd probably say between Dublin Old School and With Nail and I. That is a good comparison film, I think.
Yeah, sits somewhere between those two.
Exactly, yeah. There you go.
Last film. Playmobil, the movie.
Oh, dear.
Playmobil?
Yeah, I don't know.
You've both seen it?
No, I sent my sister and her two kids, my niece and nephew, to see it. And normally my sister is usually pretty good about like texting me after and saying, oh, thanks so much. The kids really loved it. Didn't get a text after this one. So that immediately tells me this film must suck ass. Deirdre, hit it.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was probably I think it was the worst animated movie I've seen all year.
Yeah.
Probably one of the worst movies I've seen all year.
I think of Playmobil as being really cheap crap Lego.
But is it owned by the Lego company?
I don't know.
No? I think they're separate, aren't they? Because I mean, Lego Movie is, I'm sorry to bring, like,
it was
Lego
always going to go to the Lego Movie anyway.
Like Lego Movie is Warner's and this one's like Studio Canal. So does that imply that they are different toy companies or maybe the movie studios have nothing to do with it?
I would assume they were different companies.
Yeah, that's what I would assume.
The one thing I will say is that Playmobil is a line of toys. I'm not reading this off Wikipedia.
Totally
produced by the Brandstatter Group. Headquartered in Zirndorf, Germany.
Zirndorf? Oh, that old chestnut. that old party town, let me tell you. Zirndorf, that's where shit goes down, you know what I mean? Yeah.
I just want to hear you say Zirndorf.
Zirndorf. Let's party in Zirndorf, baby. Playmobil, yeah. God, I know your big yen is animation, Deirdre.
It is, usually.
It is
usually.
Usually. You clearly could not pay me to go watch this film. Like I remember... Like,
we do pay and you haven't
You do pay me
it.
And I didn't go and I literally made my sister go. We're going to ring her up and like, here, Jennifer, what was it like? Oh, wow, really? Yeah, okay, great. Review done. There you go.
Oh, people have figured out your modus operandi.
That's how I review like 90% of it. So what was it like? Oh, that's
it's like the wife.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Playmobil, I just had no interest in this film at all.
Yeah.
And I like it's out this week and I don't think I've seen one trailer for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen no promotion for it.
See, I think that they're trying to, and I mean, all the synopses that I've seen online and everything have said like it's based on the Playmobil toys. Like nothing's giving it away story-wise.
Sure.
Which is like, I don't know if they're trying to maintain a sense of intrigue around it or just the story is so shit. So I'll tell you a bit about the story, sure. So I hated this film from the very opening scene.
Really?
Which is Anya Taylor-Joy is talking all about how she wants to go out and explore the world. And she's telling all of this to her little brother. And then she starts to sing. So already we're in a freaking musical. So I was like, oh,
what's
God,
the song?
Already?
What's the number? Give it a chance.
Honestly, the songs were so... Like the melody in them was so poor and so forgettable and the lyrics were just so basic that I couldn't even tell you. Like everything is gone. Everything is gone out of my head except for the negative feelings stay. They have stayed with me. But I was watching this like, what have they done to Anya Taylor-Joy? Like this is a phenomenal actress in the likes of The Witch, Split, etc.
Yeah,
and they've turned her into this friggin' singing, dancing Disney Channel actress. So I was really annoyed by that. Like kind
Wait,
of immediately. So it starts live action. This is what I'm getting to. And then
I thought she was voicing a character.
Yeah.
So
what age
it
is she
starts
meant to be?
Off live action.
Yeah.
And then her and her little brother get transported into the world of Playmobil. And you know what's weird? They never actually use the word Playmobil at any point in the movie. It's really weird. So like at the start, when it's still live action, there's a scene of them kind of playing with the toys together. And look, they're a family and they're so happy together, blah, blah, blah. And then there's like a family tragedy and it's like, oh no, sad. And then the little boy runs away and she runs after him and she finds him in this toy convention. And then this light shines out of a lighthouse onto them.
Yeah.
And suddenly they are animated Playmobil characters for some reason.
Yeah.
And then there's more singing with Vikings this time.
Yeah.
And then her and her brother get separated.
One question. Sorry.
Yeah.
Do they have elbows and knees in this or do they have to
No,
move?
They move like Playmobil characters. So she's like looking at her hand like, oh, what has happened? Because you know how it's like.
Yeah,
like
I remember them being even less movement than Lego.
That's, and there's a whole joke about that, about their like limited movement and everything. No, it's not brilliant. It's not brilliant at all, Owen. And then they get separated. So she has to go make friends and he has to make friends so that they can eventually find each other and find a way back home, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, it's so ramming down your throat and everything in it just feels like formulated to kind of appeal to kids. You know, you've even got like Daniel Radcliffe is playing this like super spy who does all these disguises and then he jumps out randomly. He's basically like your character, your man in Arrested Development, but really poorly done.
Oh, as in like Gene Parmesan.
Yes, Gene Parmesan.
I've got some bad news. I'm Gene Parmesan.
Oh, that was so good. Except every time I looked at it, I was like, it's Mr. Kraft. But I really wish someone had shouted that in one of the Arrested Development episodes. That would have made me
Mr.
so happy.
Kraft.
But anyway, there's like music in it. The animation is ugly. The characters are completely two-dimensional, forgettable, unlikable. There actually is no charm to this film whatsoever.
That seems like, I have to be honest with you, that seems like that takes effort.
Yeah, this is the thing. Is it all just crowd testing or whatever? Like, say something like Angry Birds 2.
Yeah.
You seem to get a bit of a laugh out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that just because of the adult themed writing or just...
I don't know.
I mean, it's always the writing is what these come down to, I suppose. But like,
really, yeah. Like, I've always believed that. Like, even like, you can have pretty crap animation and you can have something hilarious. Like South Park. South Park is terribly animated.
Yeah.
But the writing is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
it's some of the funniest stuff you're ever going to see. And then you're going to have something like, I don't know, you know, Kubo and the Two Strings. Beautifully animated.
Mm-hmm.
Really gorgeous story, but kind of forgettable in a weird kind of way.
Yeah.
Like, it's good.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Like, but with Kubo and the Two Strings, my issue with that was compared to other Laika, I think it actually went too sad.
Yes.
And that ended up like making me kind of disconnect from it because it actually went too
far. Yeah.
So that's what happened with me with that film. But I mean, I love Laika generally because they really like infuse their films with like character and heart. And I mean, we talked about this last week with the whole, if you can't get the humor, get the heart, or vice versa.
Whereas
but the
this
thing
one
is
got...
like, it had neither. There was just no kind of heart to it. Everything about it felt like formulaic and just
they're
like,
not actual characters, they're just
just
children.
Like whatchamacallit, lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
Anya Taylor-Joy was so annoying. Adam Lambert plays, I don't know, was he the emperor or something?
Okay.
And then Meghan Trainor plays this fairy who does a song at some point. And just everything about it. And then they like, basically they travel between all the different like worlds. So they're in like Vikings and they're in the fairyland and they're in the Roman Empire and they're in the cowboy Western world. And just everything like that has been done before and just boring and crap. It was crap.
Yeah.
Good.
It's good to say.
Good.
It's such a weird one as well because it's not like they're even trying to push the toys that hard. I mean, I'm sure they are now, but like it just seems like such a backwards way to be like, and then we'll get our own movie.
Yeah, I just, I honestly believe this was like one of those things where it's like somebody, the people in Playmobil saw the success of the Lego movie and they were like, damn it, get it. We want one of those.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. That's exactly what happened. And like the thing of it is that, you know, I'll be the first one to admit, when I went into the Lego movie, I was like, this is crazy. How the fuck are you going to get a movie out of Lego?
Yeah.
And it
and
was
then they did two.
And then they did two and they were brilliant. And like, it was so smart. The idea of Lego is about creativity.
Yes,
it's about holding on to the creativity of your childhood and bring it into your adult. That's so fucking smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you make, like, how do you, like, I mean, look, you know, Lego Batman movie was fine. Lego Ninjago,
pretty crap. Loved Lego Batman. That was my favorite of all of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Lego Ninjago wasn't great.
No, it was pretty poor.
They had that cat gag and that was kind of all that was going for it. And the Leloid, think. Leloid.
Like your name.
It's just
Brian
Lloyd.
Lloyd.
It's just Lloyd. Lloyd. It's just Lloyd. It's Welsh. It means Lloyd.
I thought great. Brian was Irish.
No, Lloyd is Welsh. Brian is Irish and Lloyd is Welsh. Yeah. Lloyd. It's Welsh. It means grey, apparently.
Right.
Okay.
There you go.
Thanks for joining us on the film show this week, guys. No, wait. That actually is it, isn't it?
That is.
that's actually the show.
That's actually the show, yeah. Playmobil sucks. Bye.
Okay, well, genuinely, thanks very much for listening. Check us out on Twitter at The Film Show, and we'll be back next week with some more big reviews.